I don't want to set the world.
Because I learned about kids jumping on my lap, and I've loved kids jumping on my lap.
To chase, at least for a moment, Trump and the maggots off the stage.
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?
We are the Prepper Broadcasting Network.
Welcome, everybody, to the Rising Republic. It's me, your boy, Doug Hogan, a.k.a. L. Douglas Hogan, my pen name. If you're going to be going and purchasing any of my books and reading my post-apocalyptic stuff or my patriotic stuff that I like to write. Listen, today we got Rick Tippins joining us, and he's an old friend. Yeah, we go back a few years. It's really cool. We have such a extensive history that align. Like, we were both police officers, we were both sheriff's deputies, we were both in the Marines. Not only in the Marines, but we both had the same MOS. I thought that was really, really cool. But we're going to chat a bit about what he's got going on, some of the projects he's completing, some of the things he's done. And I would like to ask him some questions about CMEs, coronal mass ejections, because he's got some novels, a series of books on this very topic. So I would like to talk to him about that. Anyway. We have an interesting day planned. I'm kind of excited about talking to Rick. And so for the next hour or so, hour and a half, we're going to be chatting it up with him. Let's see what he's got going on. Hey, can you hear me? Like, loud and clear?
I can. I can't see you, but I can hear you.
Yeah, it's a phone call. I mean, we can do video if you want to, but I'm not pretty.
Well, then I'll turn the camera off.
Yeah, turn your camera off.
Here, I got up and took a shower.
Did you? No. Didn't I say he was going to be on the phone? You got pretty and everything. You got dressed.
Yeah, I'm dressed. And I've been outside, checked my, I guess, a couple coyote traps set in the backyard. Trying to rid myself of these predators.
Right. Well, that's a good thing. I've been coyote hunting a few times. I've never had any luck. I don't know what the deal is.
They're super smart.
Yeah, I think that they're always I even one time went so far as to make a ghillie suit to try to and I would just go out and just lay there and I'd have the call machine and everything and a long distance reach out and touch someone rifle.
Yep, they're super smart. I have a little trap set in this one little area, and then we had a little call. It's about the size of like a one inch cube, and it's real low volume. They can hear it. But like, if you walk past it, you wouldn't hear it. You got to really get down to listen to it. It sounds like a distressed mouse or rat or something.
Hmm. Yeah. I had one that had like, it took like a million batteries and like a remote control. So, and it had like a lot of different animal sounds, distressed animal sounds. And, you would select a dying rabbit or, you know, a bird or chicken or whatever it was. And just hope that they'd come in. I never saw anything. I could hear them in the background, way far away in the distance, but I never got lucky.
I've had them out there for 3 or 4 days and nothing.
Well, hey, let's get into it. I have introduced you and read your bio in the, I took your bio directly off of your Amazon account, right? You got your Amazon page. I went to your biography on there. And it says that you was born in Ventura, California in 1966. So you're pushing some years, huh?
What are you talking about, man? I'm a young man.
Yeah, I know you are. You know, here's the cool thing, though, because you was in the Marines. And after the Marines, we'll get into a little bit more of this. But, what you did after the Marines, because we kind of align a little bit in some of our work history. But one of the coolest things I thought whenever I connected with you was that not only was you in the Marines, but you was in a very small group, a very small MOS, military occupational specialty. The same one I was in, right? You was an 0351 anti-tank assaultman.
I was, I mean, that's the MOS that I carried throughout my time, but I only spent about, probably less than a year in that weapons company platoon, and then I went over to Stapleton.
It was 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines. You was anti-tank, 0351. I was 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, because we were close. We were both in there at Camp Pendleton, California.
At Horno, right?
Yeah, yes, at Horno, Camp Horno. So even tighter. What years did you serve?
86 to 90.
86 to 90. And what year was you at Horno?
I got there like the end of summer of 86 and through 90.
So when you went to stay, and that's a little sniper squad, correct?
Yes, they got the four-man recon teams and then the two-man scout sniper teams.
So when you were in... Okay, so I remember when I was in weapons company, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, and we were the tow squad, which is an anti-tank assault. Unless it's like the 03. I was 0352, he was 0351, but they did the same thing pretty much. The 0351s had the smaller anti-tank weapons, and the 0352s had the larger vehicular, not very mobile anti-tank weapons. The so tow. When... You're right. The tow, the tube launched, optically tracked, wire command link, guide command link. Yeah, it's like a tongue twister. But we used to look in our platoon. Well, not our platoon, because we were a squad. We would in weapons company. In our company, we'd see these guys, these little 3-4 man squads of stay guys, and we looked up to them because they were like on their own schedule. They were like, and I don't want to compare them to SEALs. Because you know how SEALs are highly respected amongst the military brethren. And yeah. The state guys were like that within the weapons company. So
yeah,
how did you go? How did you get to that point?
I this is all pre-internet, and you wind up in these military units because you fell for a poster, hanging on a building.
Yes.
You might have been walking by and it looked pretty cool. And next thing you know, you're in boot camp and you owe them 4 years of your life. But once I got to the Marine Corps, I still had no idea what the Marine Corps had to offer. I remember they came and they recruited for recon. And I really had no idea. I was like, wow, this sounds like something that's going to make my life harder. And it was right after boot camp. And I didn't show any interest, and obviously never went to recon. But when I had been in the fleet and I did one deployment, a WESPAC, I came back and we were kind of in a downtime, and I was out in 29 Palms doing a guard duty on a S2 tent, and this scrawny first lieutenant or second lieutenant blows through the tent flap doors, and I challenged him like you're taught to do, halt, who goes there, rifle at the low ready. And he just kind of stopped. And I was like, I'm in trouble, because he's an officer. And he liked it. He's like, I've been coming in and out of this tent for 2 weeks and nobody's ever challenged me. He goes, what's your name? And we just ended up talking, and he was the platoon commander for State Platoon. And I didn't even know that our battalion had a State Platoon or what a State Platoon was. So he introduced me to what it was, and said they were looking for guys, and they had a selection process coming up, and to come over to headquarters company and talk to the platoon sergeant, who was a staff sergeant at that time. I did, went through their little selection process that at that time was a lot less than it is now. It was PFT, I think, in an interview. And away I went. I was over there pretty quickly.
So you didn't see those guys sitting off, like they weren't standing there in some lackadaisical sense of formation, dressed any way they wanted to be, usually in ghillie suits or some kind of thing that they had made on their own, just kind of standing there?
I never saw a state platoon guy before I got to the platoon. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, we got ready to run that PFT, and I went out for the little selection thing. And one of the sergeants was with the whole time, like for a half hour leading up to the run, was chain smoking. And I remember thinking, he's not going to make this run. The guy dusted all of us. Like he probably beat, the closest guy to him was probably 20 seconds behind him in a 3-mile run. And then he starts smoking again.
Well, so he did that. He did this fast paced run as a smoker. Like, I couldn't do that. When I tried smoking while I was in the Marines, and it killed me. It's like, I suffered miserably on the next run. I'm like, I cannot do that. So I, of course, being at Camp Horno, there's nothing flat anyway. And I'm, and you too, you're tall like me. I'm 6'5". What are you, like 6'3" or something? You're tall also. Running up and down those mountains. Did you have any problems doing that?
No, the physical part of the Marine Corps, you know, I felt like I excelled pretty much through, you know, boot camp. When you first get there, it's a psychological, you know, bang, you miss home. You're wondering, you know, what kind of mistake you made. But from boot camp all the way through, I never really found that the Marine Corps, I mean, I was tired at times and hurting. And, you know, you do a 26-mile hike in 8 hours with full combat gear. You know, it's not easy, but I never felt like it pushed me to my brink, anything that I went through back then.
Which is probably why, you know, once you got recruited, because you said you challenged this. What was his rank again, the guy you challenged?
Say again?
What was the rank of the gentleman you challenged? The officer, was he an officer?
Oh, yeah. He was a second lieutenant. He was a platoon commander.
Butterbars. For anybody that's listening, because we're talking a lot of military slang. STAY, we're talking about STAY platoon. It's spelled STA, and surveillance target acquisition. It's basically, it's the snipers. And they're one, probably I would say, in just my opinion, a rank under Marine Corps Special Ops, which would be the recon guys. So you were like close. Did you ever consider going to full-on reconnaissance?
No, you know, it was kind of a thing where the Marine Corps, like, I love the mission. I love the camaraderie. I love all that. I don't like the control, the lack of control of my life or the control they have over my life. So I knew I was going to get out after 4 years. And again, I didn't really know a lot about, I knew there was a recon. I knew there was a force recon. Actually, they stood that back up during those years. It had been, it went away after Vietnam, but they'd come back. And I saw those guys. I knew some of those guys. We cross-trained with both battalion recon and force recon from time to time, doing, you know, supporting them before they had a scout sniper presence within their unit. We supported them up there at one of the special operations ranges that we worked at in Camp Pendleton, doing hostage rescue. We had a shoot house up there, and they would breach and go in and shoot the place up, and we would shoot sentries off the top of the buildings and, you know, all that happy stuff. But I was moving on. I didn't know what to, but I was moving on someplace where I had more control over my life.
I remember being in that situation also, because if you know, we got several hundred people listen to the podcast. When you go into the military, you lose, you basically sign your life away to the government. You don't have rights, as you know, your First Amendment rights, your second, you know, all these things that we have as civilians, you don't have as a military person. You don't get to travel outside of a certain, you have to ask permission to travel outside. I want to say it was like 20 miles. When I was in the service, you're not allowed, people did it, got tattoos, but you're not weren't supposed to get tattoos on your body. And all these different things, you have a different set of laws applied to you even. You have what's called the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's a separate set of laws that govern you as a military personnel. It's completely different than the civilian laws that are in the Constitution that are afforded to normalized citizens. So being able to put ourselves in those situations voluntarily, first of all, I want to thank you for that, for your service, because you knew what you were doing. You signed up for that. You just didn't know exactly how much control you were losing going into the military. And you don't really feel the gravity of it until you're in the situation and they're telling you what to eat, what to drink, where you can and can't go. And that's when you begin to feel, especially if you're married. Was you were you married when you were in the military?
No, I was not.
Because I was a brown bagger. I got married just before. Brown baggers, for anybody listening, is somebody they call somebody that takes their lunch to work. So for me, I lived off base, and I would take my lunch with me to work if I got to eat it, kind of a thing. So they called us brown baggers. But it's funny that you mentioned control, and you didn't like the sense of control that you felt you didn't have over your life. But I see that after, in your bio, as soon as you got out of the Marines, you went and joined, you got into law enforcement, right?
Well, I wish it had gone that quickly. Again, you know, no internet, you know, you really have no idea. The kids now, man, if you want to do something, and I don't care what it is, you can research it, and literally, I mean, a few hours of research, and you'll never know the feelings of being someplace and doing something, but you'll at least have an understanding of what to expect and how the process plays out. And to become a cop, as you know, it can take 6 months, can take a year to get hired, right?
Right.
And so I knew somebody who knew somebody who knew a captain at the police department in my hometown. And I went and met with this old guy, and he'd been around forever. And he told me, yeah, you know, we'll get you signed up, and it'll be, the hiring process is 6 months. Well, I joined the Marine Corps in like 10 days. And I was like, 6 months? And when you're, you know, 22 or 3 or whatever I was at the time, 6 months is a significant amount of time just in relationship to how long you've been alive. So I was like, I'm not doing that. So I went and got another job working in a warehouse. I worked for a car dealership. Both of those jobs lasted probably together about 6 months. And then I went and worked construction for a while. And then I realized, like, yeah, I can't do the rest of my life working construction, because the guys I was working with, most of them were really good guys, but it was like, you know, there was the guy that drank all day on the job and worked, you know, heavy equipment. There was, every night we got off, it was back to the, you know, the property where they stored all the equipment, and then it was drinking. And I was like, I can't sustain this tempo of, you know, abuse for the next 40 years. I just, you know, I can't do it. So I put myself through the academy, like quit my job. I was washing cars on the weekend to make money. I was washing cars after school to make money. And I put myself through the police academy. And then while I was in the police academy, I applied to dozens and dozens of agencies. And one of the agencies about an hour south of where I grew up, East Palo Alto, which is not to be mistaken with Silicon Valley's Palo Alto, but they're connected. They're just in different counties, and they're completely different cities. I got hired there in 1992.
As a sheriff's deputy?
As a police officer.
Police officer? Okay, so you was municipal police first.
Yep.
And then I see that you went on to join San Mateo Sheriff's Office.
Yeah, I did about 2.5, almost 3 years at East Palo Alto Police, and the department had a ton of problems. It was super violent. I mean, they were the murder capital of the whole country per capita my first year there. I'm trying to think. They'd killed one of the officers before I got there. They killed another one right after I left, and they shot one while I was there. So, like, it wasn't just bad guys killing bad guys. There was cops. We were losing cops, and cops were getting hurt. And that was just shooting stuff. Cops were hurt all the time in fights. I had my shoulder fully rebuilt by an orthopedic surgeon after a fight in that city with a bad guy over a crack pipe, of all things. Stupidest thing ever. But yeah, I realized that my future there, it was like an NFL running back. It was so high impact that I wasn't going to last. So I went to the sheriff's office and took like a pay increase by like 2 or 3 times what the East Palo Alto guys were making, and had a lot more opportunities there within that office.
People make a mistake of confusing like working for smaller towns. And I, you know, the town that you worked, East Palo Alto, was a lot bigger than the smaller towns I work with in Southern Illinois, you know, doing municipal police work. But people, it's the what I'm trying to say, the context is the same, because people mistake in thinking, they make a mistake in thinking that just because it's a smaller community, that there's going to be less crime there. But that's not at all how it is, because I've, in my findings, because where I lived, there's major highways and a lot of major East St. Louis suburban kind of communities that would pass through and bring all the problems with them. What was closest to EPA to you that you think was bringing a lot of the crime to the smaller community?
Are you prepared to be the family doctor in a disaster or emergency? This is the Intrepid Commander, and I'm holding the Prepper's Medical Handbook by William W. Forgy, MD. In this great book, you'll learn how to prepare for medical care off the grid. You'll learn about assessment and stabilization. You'll even deal with things like bioterrorism response, radiation, and how to build the off-grid medical kit at home. Look, 2020 taught us a lot about the limitations of our medical infrastructure in America. Get the Prepper's Medical Handbook today at Amazon.com. Again, that's the Prepper's Medical Handbook by William W. Forgy.
Well, East Palo Alto is kind of a unique town. So you have, at that time, it was mostly Black and Hispanic, almost, I would say, more Black, like 45% Blacks, 35% Hispanic, and the rest were like Pacific Islanders, Tongans. And the gangs, the Black gangs, and a lot of the Hispanic gangs, younger gangs, it was just territorial. It wasn't money making as much as it was just territorial. Like, they're getting a fight over a girl, and, you know, 3 months later, there'd be, you know, 13, 14 dead, you know, from shootings that strung over that, you know, 3 month period. But there also was some of the older Hispanic groups were linked to the cartels, you know, coming out of Mexico and South America. So you had, but they were usually pretty quiet. You know, every once in a while, somebody would make somebody mad and you'd get a triple homicide in a house, and we wouldn't have any clues. We would, you know, the neighbors didn't hear anything, and you just find three dead bodies. It was, you know, a hit, but those are pretty rare. Most of the shootings were, you know, these little poo-butt, you know, under 25-year-old gang members running around shooting each other up, or because you went too far into their neighborhood or something like that. And there wasn't, the only really drug trafficking thing was the older Hispanics that were, like I said, linked with the cartels. And they were, for the most part, you know, they're trying to keep their business under wraps and not bring attention to themselves. So they weren't a huge part of the problem.
What county did East Palo Alto, what county was it in?
San Mateo County.
So
it's it lies between San Francisco. Actually, San Francisco Airport is in San Mateo County. But that county runs down the peninsula between the bay and the Pacific Ocean, down to where Santa Clara County starts, which San Jose and Palo Alto and Mountain View and all that, down where the meat of Silicon Valley is, down in Santa Clara County, right below San Mateo County. But they all, well, I shouldn't say they all, but a lot of Silicon Valley lives in San Mateo County, because there's some very, very, very wealthy real estate areas in the county.
Ain't it crazy how you can get such diversity as, you know, extremes? You got your high crime element, you got your higher poverty rates, and then you got these extremely rich and powerful crime-free zones, all right there in one county.
Doug, they're within a pistol shot of each other sometimes. Like,
that's crazy.
East Palo Alto, I could drive from a murder scene 7 minutes and be parked in front of a $50 million estate in Atherton.
So when you went to to work for the county, you didn't really get rid of that, though, because now, I mean, East Palo Alto had their own police officers, but you would still have, we have what's called mutual aid in Illinois. If East Palo Alto is in need of more assistance and you're on call, say you're working for the county, you would be dispatched, correct, to them to help out with an issue?
If they called, and historically, like when I first got to East Palo Alto Police as a young police officer, a municipal guy, the sheriff's office had 3 in the afternoon to 3 in the morning, a crew of like 3 deputies and a sergeant that augmented us. When I cleared the field training program almost to the day, I can't remember if it was exactly to the day, but it sure felt like it. The sheriff's office pulled out because they weren't being, I don't know, they had some issue with the city and they were losing money and whatever. So they pulled out. And when those, you know, 4 guys left, it left us 3 guys there by ourselves in this city. And I think that's kind of why we had that high murder rate that year, because people knew there was just 3 of us and they could kind of run wild. And there was only so much sand we could shovel as a team, you know, against the incoming tide. But I got sidetracked. What was your question? Oh,
no, we were talking about covering some of these issues, being working for the sheriff's department and having to still deal with the East Palo Alto and their issues.
Yeah. So later in my career at the sheriff's office, they went back to augmenting East Palo Alto's patrol group. And I was the first one they'd ever sent back down there who'd been an East Palo Alto officer. For whatever reason, the sheriff never, if you had been a cop there, they never sent you back down there as a deputy. And I got to go back down there and work for, but not a whole, I was on my way to the narcotics task force. So I had probably 6 months down there, four or five or six months, I can't remember exactly, before I left and went and grew my hair long and did all that stuff.
You grew your hair long after being in the military and after being a police officer?
Oh yeah, I had beautiful flowing
like
locks.
Oh good Lord. What was that that gay guy that with the big muscles that always appear on the magazines and the women would just swoon over him? Fabio? Was you
Fabio?
Did you have Fabio hair?
Guy, right?
Yeah, do you have any pictures?
Nor the muscles.
I'm gonna have to see some pictures to believe it. To for this to form in my head, I'm gonna have to see some pictures.
I think I have some up on I don't know, maybe Facebook. Some narcotics task force era.
That's awesome. Pictures. I'm definitely going to dig into your Facebook page a little bit more, because I'm going to have to see those pictures, and also, you know, towards the end of the podcast, give you an opportunity to tell us how to reach you, so I can have my listeners also go in and take a peek at your stuff there. That sounded bad. Have a peek at your photographs on Facebook, because I think it's not only our friendship, because we've known each other for a few years now, and how we came together was kind of cool too. Because I look back, not only was you in the Marines, but you was an anti-tank guy like me, and then you was a municipal police officer like I was, and then you was in the sheriff's department like I was. You did your stuff full-time, though. I've always been part-time, and kind of where we deviate a little bit was I went on to work in a maximum security mental health facility. I did that for 25 years, simultaneously working part-time police jobs, part-time sheriff jobs, doing all those other things. And I remember sometimes when I was a sheriff's deputy working in for the county, and there were some of these smaller towns and didn't have police officers, their own police. So I would spend time in those areas. And there came a time, especially with some of the wackadoo crazy laws that were coming into effect, some of these departments were worried about not having police coverage and wondering how they were going to get covered. And I remember kind of wondering if we was going to create some kind of situation where we could get augmented, but there was, I didn't really have to worry about being augmented or mandated, probably another word for a lot of people listening, being mandated to work in those kind of positions because I was a part-timer. That was a full-time thing that was contractual, that the full-time guys could get mandated and not the part-time guys. Because I only signed up for what was available. If there was an open on the shift, I would go and sign up for it. So when you went to work for San Mateo County, how often did you have, what kind of issues did you have with illegal immigrants?
With illegals?
Yes.
I mean, everybody was illegal, you know, in those lower income areas.
Uh-huh.
When I worked in East Palo Alto, I didn't really deal with it because you just didn't have time.
Right.
But I went to the sheriff's office in, you know, the early 90s. We would kind of use it as like if they were in contempt of the cop, if you will, you know, they wanted to have an attitude or something. That was just a hammer you could drop on them and call INS. And I don't even think they call it that anymore. I think it's ICE now, right? Or something ICE, like that. Yeah. But we had a great INS guy at the time, and if the cops called and said, hey, this guy's, you know, that guy was gone. So the one time that I did really work with them is, and this is 96, 97, like in that era. So I was part of a gang task force that was and when I say task force, it was because it was sheriff's office personnel and it was personnel from a neighboring agency. And it was headquartered in that neighboring agency's building, which was the same city that the county seat is in. I'm trying not to name names, but you can figure it out if you figure it out. But anyway, their chief of police was from south of the border and was a hater of INS and had a standing order for his police officers that they were never to work with INS, not to cooperate with them. And that the only time they could do anything with them is if INS was calling for like cover. So we have a murder where these Sereno gang members, and Sereno are the Southerners. They're mostly in Southern California, and the Norteños are the Northerners. They're mostly in Northern California. And it comes from the prison systems, and I could go and talk for a whole nother hour about that. But either way, Sereños. So most of the Sereños, a lot of the Northerners are legal, and almost all of the Southerners are illegal. So we had the Southerner problem, and they'd killed one guy, and they were doing a bunch of other violent acts. And so I brought it to our sergeant, who was worked for that chief of police. And I said, hey, why don't we get INS, and we'll just go and we'll deport all these guys, and then we don't have a problem. And he's like, we can't do that. We can't work with them. And at that time, the sheriff's office was a lot different than it is now. Sheriff's deputies just handled their business, you know, and nobody asked me what I was doing or how I was doing it. And as long as I wasn't committing crimes, you know, and getting results, they were okay with it. So I went and got this INS agent, and we rode for 2 weeks, and we scooped up like 17 bad guys and sent them back. And on the 10th day, one that we'd sent back, we saw him walking. So we snatched him up again. We took him to his parents' house, and the INS guy told his parents that his parents were legally trying to immigrate to the U.S. And he told him, he said, if we see your son back in the United States, it'll, instead of 10 years for all this paperwork to go through, I'll make sure it takes 30 years. And that I never saw that guy again. So that worked, but obviously that was the end of that state's sanity as far as, you know, how they deal with illegals. And even the sheriff's office, you know, within, I would say, 10 years of that date was not working with ICE and not allowing them to come into jail and do their job.
This is unbelievable. So I kind of went back and looked at the population of East Palo Alto. And it's right now, like as of last year anyway, at least estimated at 23,000. Was it similar?
East Palo Alto? Yeah. It's always been right around 25-ish.
Okay. And you said almost every one of them was illegal, at least the ones you had contact with.
Yeah.
So,
and like I said, they weren't all Mexicans in that town. There was, I bet you there was 10,000, 8,000, 8 or 10,000.
Yeah, you said roughly 45% or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. So this is crazy because we're looking back because we got the catch and release crap that was going on with Obama, and it's going on now. It's probably, the border is in a much worse situation now under Biden. than it's ever been. We basically have a no border rule at this time, and trying to catch Congress admitting it, they're actively demonstrating it by inaction. All right, but when they're on camera, they won't admit to it. So we got this flood of illegals coming over the border all the time, and it sounds like, since you was in Clinton's police force, like I was in Clinton's Marine Corps, it sounds like this has just been going on for a long, long time.
Yes, it has. We have the laws in place for proper immigration. My wife is, her parents immigrated from Iran when the revolution was happening, and they saw the writing on the wall there in that country. And they did it the right way. I don't know why.
Well, because your wife is a good person. And just so everybody knows, I know Rick and his whole family. We've been friends for a long time. But your wife is a good person, and her mom and dad, I don't know her mom and dad except through you, but they raised a good woman. And so they have to be good too. And they went and did it the right way. And I have no problem with immigrants, and I know you don't either, because we pretty much, we're down the same, we think the same when it comes to this kind of stuff. But immigration is a good thing. The United States is a melting pot of cultures. It's a melting pot of races and all kinds of these things. But you got to get here the right way.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues. And a lot of decisiveness or divisiveness in the country right now, perpetuated by social media and the mainstream media and even some of the, media on both sides, left and right. I think people need to get back to some common sense thinking, in my opinion, but I'm just a young man. So what do I know?
Well, your opinion is welcome here. I mean, that's what this show's all about. I'm actually opinion is literally what I do. So your opinions are welcome. Lay them out for me. Also, the conspiracy thing, it's big on my talk show, or my podcast rather. My whole tyrant series began with an out of control border situation where these illegals were streaming over, and we get all these different, it's not just Hispanic people that are coming over the border. You get elements from terrorist organizations that jump in that mix and come across also. And so people are calling the United States racist, or whoever believes that we should have a border calling us racist, which is just nonsense, because we believe in safety. It has nothing to do with your race. I don't care if you're coming over the border as an English person or an Hispanic person, an Indian person. I don't care. Do it legally, because we need some checks and balances, or else we're going to have a serious problem down the road.
That's true. Everything needs checks and balances. I mean, look at Mother Nature. You get, let's say deer. I have 8 deer that move through my property every day, right? And then a couple months later, or next year, the coyotes are not doing their job, and now I have 15 or 18 deer moving through the property. And, then that herd is big enough, and it grows again the next year. And at one point they're if they're not checked, by predators, they eat up all the food source, right? And then they start to starve to death, or disease sets in. I mean, Mother Nature has ways of balancing things out. And I think it would be in humanity's best interest for us not to reach those levels for ourselves, where, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people have to die off to make things right in Mother Nature again.
Yeah, I actually was, I had I think it was 3 shows ago, I had Sarah Hathaway, you might be familiar with her, on the show. We was talking about how the earth has its own way of kind of controlling things. And it's a balance. Everything is a balance. And I believe that everything is a balance in life. And if the United States, every single thing is in balance and in harmony, should be in harmony. But if something is thrown out of whack, thrown off balance, then it starts a cascade of problems and issues. And this avalanche of problems begin to occur. And in this case, with immigration, we can see job issues. We can see food supply issues. We can see terrorist supply or terrorist issues. We can see all kinds of things being thrown out of balance because the border issue is not where it's supposed to be. And like you said, we have laws in place. We have a way to naturalize. That's why INS initially stood for, right? It was like the Immigration Naturalization Services, you know, and before they changed their name to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which they might need it and it might be due for a change again because they're not enforcing anything. Just having officers pick these guys up and say, yeah, just release them back out into the public. And then they go back out into the public again. And like you were picking them up again, you know, here we go. We got a problem where we're catching them and releasing them. And then we got pictures, next thing we know, of people in cages and being blamed on other presidents had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, the world's in a rough way, not just the U.S. I mean, we're kind of the last bastion of freedom, I think, and we probably don't have as much freedom as we think we do. And part of it is we've enslaved ourselves, like with the social media stuff, people, including you and I, use it to make a living. And so once you rely on it for money, they have control. They have a certain amount of control over you, right?
Right.
And you don't say what they want to hear, then they can exert that control. And I mean, it's I don't know. There's a lot of badness going on in the world. And like you said earlier, it's not a racial thing. I mean, I'm married to a Persian for crying out loud. You know, when I was in the Marine Corps, the Iran was the big bag boogeyman. And I know a lot, you know, more now that I've been in this family for almost 20 years, and it's a lot like America. The country, the people are no different than pretty much any other country. It's the governments that are the problem.
And that's what I was going to get ready to point out next, that we often talk about countries. And if you have something to say against the country, you're racist. But when I say I don't like Mexico, for example, well, I don't, but it has nothing to do with Mexican people. Not at all. I don't like their government. They don't do nothing. They put so much effort into tourist areas, and the government lives lavishly while most of the populace is struggling to survive. And so why not try to make a life better for yourself? You can't blame a person for trying to cheat their way into the United States, right? Because their own country has not been fair to them.
Yep.
Who is on your side, PBN family? When it comes to healthcare, I know no better ally than the folks at the Wellness Company. They've been our sponsor now for months, and I want you to look at their monthly membership. Visit twc.health/PBN. For $10 a month or less, your membership gets you discounted supplements and wellness products, discounted virtual care, and discounts on most specialty telehealth services. I'm talking allergy immunotherapy, freedom from pharma, vaccine injury. These people get it. They get you, and they are the future of healthcare. Visit twc.health/PBN.
You mentioned a word a while ago. You said bastion, and made me think, because we got to talk about your book series here. You've been writing for a little bit. When was your first book? When was it first put out? A World Slow.
2018, I think.
Let's look it up real quick here. I'm going to pull you up on Amazon. I'll look at World Slowed. It must have been relaunched in 2022.
Yeah, well, that was with Raven Thorne. No, okay. I self-published it in 2018 because I retired in February from law enforcement. I did some stuff with screenplays in Hollywood for a minute, and that was just an absolute disaster of an endeavor and soured me to that industry pretty much. And so then I'd written the book A World Slowed while the last 2 years I was working at the sheriff's office, and rewrote it probably four or five times and released it. Figured out I talked to one of our mutual acquaintances and Marine,
Jeff
Hoff. Mm-hmm. Jeff G. Michael Hoff. And I'd read some of his books, and I reached out to him, and he reached back out to me, to his credit, and walked me through the process. And I think that's where I met you because you did the first cover, right?
Yes, he put me in touch with you, and he allowed us to communicate back and forth. And once I did that, you told me, because he told me when he's getting ready to connect, he always reached out to me and said, hey, I'm going to get you in touch with this guy. You'll like him. He's a Marine. Well, yeah, you know, put me in touch with another Marine. I like to build my network, and especially if it's a Marine fellow author kind of a situation, which turned out to be. And we began talking, and we I remember the first time we talked for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, we're driving to meet each other and going to the same book signing events. And it's been a good time.
Yeah. The first time we met was when we realized we couldn't raise our kids out in California. And we flew out to Nashville to look at the area around Nashville, not in Nashville. And you popped down from up north, and we had dinner and couple of drinks, maybe. I can't remember. And,
yes. You probably don't remember that night, but I did. I definitely had more than a couple of drinks.
Yeah. And then we got up the next morning and we went looking for houses, and you headed back home.
Yeah. I remember. Good time.
Yeah.
You remember, and you bought me a couple of drinks. Thank you for that. That's where I got to meet your wife and children, too. Great people.
Yeah. All three of them.
Oh, yes. So let's talk about your books a little bit. How A World Slowed was your first book. Tell me what's the context behind your book, and what was the catalyst that set things going southward?
Well, let me go back like 2 minutes.
Yes.
And say that in 1994, after working in East Palo Alto and running around, you know, shots fired every 3 seconds and all that, I got hired by the sheriff's office. They put me on midnights in the jail. And there's no slower place in the world. A monastery, a funeral home has more activity in it than the jail does at night.
Been there. Yep.
And so I'm pacing the cage like a tiger, right?
Right.
But there's nothing to do because they're all sleeping and I'm just walking in circles.
Yeah, you're a go-getter. You want to put your mind to work.
So one of my brothers had a hair up his nose about writing screenplays. And so that got me going in the writing thing. And I taught myself how to write screenplays. And screenplays or books, it's just a different format for a story. You know what I mean? You can write the same story. In fact, it's done. There's so many books that have been turned into movies. And so I wrote, I don't know. I have a whole stack of screenplays sitting next to me right now that I wrote, dating all the way back to 1994, that I slowly have been turning into books when I get the time. And they're not a series, that each one of them is like a standalone, could be a series, probably all of them. And so that's kind of what got me into writing. And every time, you know, I'd get transferred to a gang unit, then I wouldn't write for a few years because you just don't have the time. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go back to the jail and I'd write for a year. And then I'd go out to narcotics and I wouldn't write. So I get promoted to lieutenant. And I arrive at the jail the first day and I'm like, yes, I'm going to change everything and I'm going to motivate and I'm going to lead. And then I walked around and it's a lieutenant, 3 sergeants, and then, you know, all the staff. And I walked around for about 2 hours and I realized, yeah, the lieutenant doesn't do a thing around here. Sergeants run everything. So I went back to my office and I started writing that book. And I wrote it based off of I'd lived in the East Bay, in a little town called Danville, which is about 50 or 60 miles away from where I worked. And I used to take my two young kids at that time. They were babies, like in car seats. And I would drive them across the San Mateo Bridge up to my in-law's house. And my mother-in-law would take care of them during the day. And then I would drive and pick them up. Well, I started thinking, like, you know, I was listening to these books on tape, A American and his Going Home series,
right?
Hoff series, John O'Brien. Not really a John O'Brien writes the like zombie stuff, but I for whatever reason I liked his books, and so I put together a kit in the back of my car. I had a Bob stroller, you know. I figured I could put both the kids in that, and I could push them. I had a rifle, you know, that I carried at work, and I had 3 days worth of food. Some water purification. I had sleeping, a little small tent and sleeping bag for the kids. Cause I figured I really wouldn't be sleeping that much if we had to walk home. And I remember my father-in-law looking in my trunk one day and going like, what is all this for?
Just in case.
I like looked at him and he was, you know, I think there was some judging going on. Like, what kind of psycho did my daughter marry?
Yeah, they always raise an eyebrow to that kind of stuff.
I said, well, you never know if there's going to be an earthquake. I got to get home to my wife with the kids. And so in the Bay Area or California, an earthquake's a real thing, right? So he's like, oh, that's a good idea.
Yes. So,
and I mean, it was. There could be a horrible earthquake. Loma Prieta was pretty bad, you know, but it could get worse than that. Who knows? But yeah, so I wrote that book. Then I retired. I published it. And started writing Tears of Chaos, the follow-up to it. Then continued to write that series. I think there's five or six books in that series.
You have 6 books in the series. And I recognize, let me see here. I think you had Christian Benchlin do book covers for 1 and 2, I think. And I think I did, I did the original color for book 1, but it needed an overhaul. And then he did a good job on the first and second one. And then I think I did 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah. And I closed that series out kind of this with the last book, Sum of All 4 Seasons. It kind of the whole series chronicalizes a single year, so 4 seasons, and how, you know, a computer nerd kind of grew up in that period of time without losing his humanity.
What period of time? What happened? Was it an EMP? Was it an invasion of some kind of the southern border? What was it?
It was a solar flare followed by like EMP wars between the surviving countries, you know, that because, I mean, honestly, do you think America is going to suffer something that brings her to her knees and not try to level the playing field? I'm not in the meetings in the Pentagon, but I got to think I've seen the way these politicians and these leaders hold on to power for dear life.
Right.
And the U.S. is not going to, you know, be removed from their position at the power table.
Right.
So that's kind of, I mean, that's not a huge part of the book. The book is more at the, you know, ground level with Jared, the main character, and the people that he meets and the relationships he builds and the losses he goes through and the things he has to do and how they affect him internally. Cause he's not built to be, you know, a Marine or a war fighter. He's a peaceful guy, but he also learns, like, you know, in order to survive, sometimes you have to do ugly things. And it's not because you're choosing to do it. It's because you're being forced by these other people to do it.
Right. Which is going to be most of the United States, right? You got a small percentage like you and I who were military trained, and another percentage of people who are both, well, who was like police trained. So, you know, heavy self-defense stuff. And then you got an even smaller group of people who are both military and police trained. But you look, the majority of the United States population is going to be just like your character Jared in your Jared Chronicles storyline.
Yep. And here, the more I write in this genre and the more I get out, like, California is a great place. I grew up there. Geographically, it's got to be maybe overall, it has more to offer than any other state. I mean, you can ski, there's deserts, there's pine forests, there's redwood forests. It's gorgeous, but they've lost their way politically. But now that but backpacking there is, you know, most of the time it's pretty even weather, you know. You might get down. I mean, obviously you're not probably backpacking up in the Sierras in the middle of winter, but here in Tennessee, Middle Tennessee, where we're at, you get, even in the summer, you can get, you know, rainstorms that roll in and just absolutely drench everything you have if you're not prepared. So it's made me, in being out with my son and Boy Scouts, like, really take a step back and look at how prepared you have to be and how used to a certain climate you have to be. And if you're not from that area, you're going to get, you know, rolled over. And through all of that, I'm starting to realize, like, you know, the military guy or the police officer guy is probably not the guy that has the best chance of surviving, but it's the local who knows how to grow their own food, you know, who might be hunts, you know, so they know how to handle a weapon. But they're going to have, in my opinion, a better chance at surviving than, you know, some sleeved out, tattooed former Special Forces guy.
I would have to agree, because I have had friends in the past who were like you and I, and they would tell me about what they would do in the, you know, in this kind of a situation, this kind of an event. And it wasn't pretty. It seems like those people that, let's say, cause I'm happy to say that I'm in prepper groups. Do I have all the knowledge I do to have, you know, be able to survive alone? Not yet. I'm getting there. I say we're all a work in progress. Anybody that's in these prepper groups and survivalist groups and all this, we're all a work in progress. I am happy to say that I'm married to a horticulturalist and somebody who likes to grow, and she has a green thumb and stuff like that. So that's all Jim Dandy. But that alone is not good enough. You need to be able to handle firearms. You need to be physically fit. I talked last week with I mentioned Hathaway earlier. Something else we talked about was being physically fit, because there's a lot of people in this world who have great prepper skills. They have great, they can make traps. They grow their own vegetables. But can they walk 25 miles with a backpack if they have to? Can they shoot and defend their homestead if they have to? There's a huge spectrum of skills that a person has to have to be effective.
That's true. I was just talking to my son yesterday. We were driving home about, we were saying if the last weekend we were backpacking and we were about 150 miles east of the house, right? And it's all through some pretty rugged country. I mean, you could walk the country roads. People out west drive on these big 6, 7, 8 lane highways everywhere. And out here, we do have interstates, you know, 65 and, you know, 24 and 40 and all that stuff. But a lot of times when you want to go places, you're on smaller roads for miles and miles and miles. And I was telling him that, you know, we walked about 12 miles on this backpacking trip, and we were all done, right? And I'm like, if you had to go home, it's going to take us about 3 weeks to get home. And he was like, no. And I'm like, yeah, it'll take you 3 weeks, because you got to figure you're only conservatively probably going to move about 10 miles a day. And you're going to have to take days off. And if something goes wrong with your feet or your shoulder starts, you know, you start creating or getting some injury, you're going to have to stop, because you can't keep going to where you're not mobile anymore, because then you'll die. And it's funny, he's 12, but we had this, you know, deep conversation about moving long distances, you know, underweight, and how we would distribute and throw some of the stuff out, because you don't need two sleeping sets of sleeping gear, because one of us is going to be up on watch, right? So we'll lighten the load that way. And, you know, most of our load would be food and water.
Right. And it's really important, because we're living in a time right now, because, you know, you I'm sure you did a lot of solar type of research whenever you're building your storyline. But I think it's inevitable. I think that at some point something's going to happen. It might not happen in the United States, but it'll happen somewhere in the world, because solar flares are they're increasing. And fortunately, we've had some very close calls. And just so everybody, I'm going to read something real quick here just for our listeners. And this is from space.com on what a solar flare is. It's a large explosion from the surface of the sun that emits intense bursts of electromagnetic radiation. The intensity of the explosion determines what classification the flares belong to. The most powerful are class X flares, followed by M, C, B class, and A class flares, which are the smallest. So these flares, when they erupt, most of them have if the ones that are toward the Earth tend to dissipate before they get here. But there's others that have, fortunately, have been out, or the Earth has been out of the way, has rotated out of the way of the flare, and they have gone out and expanded out beyond the rotation of where the Earth would have, you know, where we got very lucky, very fortunate. But for those that don't understand the severity of this, anything that's electromagnetic that hits the Earth would be the same as a giant massive electromagnetic pulse, or an EMP, that a lot of our post-apocalyptic readers are used to reading about. This type of flare would, if it hit the United States, would wipe out all of our electronics, just like an EMP would.
Yeah.
And that's the storyline behind what the Jared Chronicles is going. So you wrote 6 books, and this normal kid is trying to survive in this situation. And how was his backpacking journey?
Well, so when I started, I've read all these books, right? Morgan, the character from Going Home, Chris Weatherman or A Americans guy. He's totally capable guy, gun guy, you know, kills like 3 dudes in the first 3 days he's going home. And I'm not taking anything away from Chris's books, because I'm rereading them right now.
Yeah.
I just started like this week rereading Going Home, and I love Morgan. I love that character. Thad, his other big black guy character that he has in that book. It seemed like all of them were like Marines, former cop, you know, survivalist. And I wanted to get away from that and have a character that was a little more of a damsel in distress, but a super intelligent one who could figure it out. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Instead of brawn his way out, if you will, or fight his way, gun his way out, whatever you want to say, he was going to think his way out. So if you read Alone and Unafraid, what's it called? World Slowed. He's a very cerebral guy, young man. And he goes home, you know, he finally walks home, and he's seeing it, the world starting to devolve around him, and realizes like he doesn't have anything at home, and goes to the grocery store and gets into some trouble there and goes home. And then that's when he really realizes like, okay, I need to prioritize everything. And he makes a list on his wall with a Sharpie, and he realizes like, you know, where am I going to get all this stuff? And he goes to an REI and pretty much raids the REI for what he's going to need. And he tries to, his intention is to go to Florida where his parents are. He's through the whole series, he never makes it there, obviously, because that's, you know, just not within his capabilities. And he heads south, and he, you know, hooks up with a guy who is a retired cop, but he's super old and he's dying. So I don't introduce a capable guy into that story until the end. I believe it's the end of book one. He kind of is a big brother to Jared. His name's John. And the whole book, you know, the life of the book is Jared coming of age and then, you know, ending the series, you know, without John's help, because John helps him a lot in the beginning of those books.
It's really super cool that you did that, because I think most of, like I said earlier, most of America, you kind of thought outside the box on this and not going back to, you know, the same old humdrum of let's take somebody who's above average and throw them into an extraordinary situation and watch him fight his way out. You took someone who was below average, or no, actually, yeah, we'll just say average, and threw him into an extraordinary situation and had him try to fight his way out of it. And your books, your 6 books in the Jared Chronicles have been successful, and they're beautiful covers. But you've also wrote a couple more books, and you've done that with Raventhorn Books in the October Fall world. Can you talk to me a little bit about California Fall 1 and 2?
I was lucky enough to get contacted by some of an author from that was just starting out with Raventhorn, Robin
Vandersice.
Yeah. And
another mutual friend.
Yeah. She brought me into the fold there, and they have a pretty unique situation where they have they had 4 books written about an event, and it's based in Florida. And that was written by Mark Lauren. And the books did really well. And so the owner of Raventhorn, one of the owners, or both of the owners, Boyd and Lee, decide they are going to recruit writers from all over the country to write about the same event, but from different perspectives and with different characters. So I write from the perspective of Cam and his family. And they were from Tennessee. They flew out to San Francisco to see family. And when they landed, this all happened. The EMP hits, and America's invaded by China and North Korea soon after. And there's people, there's a C.K. Redlinger just released the Georgia Fall book, which is really good. I read that. It's kind of, he was a cop too and a Marine, go figure. And it has a little bit crime fiction in it, as well as, you know, the post-apoc stuff. And it's I know some of the readers really like this community type stuff. He has a lot of that in it. So we have I don't know how many writers they have now.
Well, there's 26 books I'm seeing in the series.
Yeah, they've got a lot of writers writing from Indiana Fall, Texas Fall, Michigan Fall, Korea Fall, you know, California Fall, which is mine, and California Fall 2. In fact, I got like 105,000 words done on California Fall 3, so that's getting real close to being published, probably by before Christmas, hopefully. I wanted to do it by the Marine Corps birthday, but it's not going to, I don't have enough time.
Yeah, we always set deadlines, and I have the most problems meeting deadlines. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So anyway, those books are, you know, they're my stories, you know, but they're not my event. We all collaborate. We have monthly meetings. So sometimes we'll cross-pollinate, like my characters can show up in somebody else's books or vice versa. You might mention a conversation over ham radio between two groups, you know, that are in two different books, like the California Fall book and, you know, I don't know, one of the other ones, Georgia, whatever. So that the readers seem to like that crossing over stuff a lot. And we try to, you know, make sure we're not stepping on each other's feet, and that we have a general storyline and a general timeline that all of us authors are following. So nothing's, you know, no, we don't leave any holes out there where people are scratching their heads.
Right. Yeah. That's very important when you're doing, especially with anthologies and things like that, where people work together. We, you know, I actually did a book with L.L. Akers, Patty Glaspie and Boyd Craven, be the third, called Archie's Heart. And it started out, we were doing something for disabled American veterans, DEV, and we didn't make a dime off of it, but we just wanted to collaborate, put out a story. Each of us was going to do it like an anthology, make a story of our own. But Patty wrote this really good story, and I'm like, oh, that's really good. You mind if I wrote a story that piggybacks off of that? And she said, sure. And then so I read her story, then I wrote mine, you know, it was like a continuation of her story. And then I passed it on to Boyd, and he said, oh, that's really good. I'm going to do the same thing. So he wrote like the third part, and L.L. Akers did like the fourth part. And and back and forth it went, you know, until we got the final version of it approved. And it was great. It was wildly successful. But it takes a lot of work to make sure that all the details are right, because you got to know if another author is writing something, you don't want to make the mistake of killing a character that he created. You know what I'm saying? So when you're communicating with us, with any of these other authors, in Mark Loren, for example, you can't take a character from his book and write it into your book and do something with him, because he owns that character, right? Like, that's just ethics 101.
Yeah, that's why we have these. For instance, in one of the meetings, I had one of the other authors come to me and say, hey, the area that this author is writing in is an area where one of my, and it's really just kind of he is a supporting cast and supporting at the lowest level cast member. But his background, I do a background on him, just a paragraph, and he's from the area where she's writing. And she's like, hey, can I have this girl, you know, missing this guy and talk about him so that we cross pollinate like that? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And then the more I thought about it, at some point my character Cam wants to go back home to Tennessee, right? And I think he probably will. I don't know how many books are going to be in the California Fall before I have to do like some travel fall or Tennessee fall or something like that. But I want to take this character with him as he moves across country and drop him off. And then she can take that character and she'll own him. She can kill him. She can marry him off. She can do whatever she wants.
Well, that's cool. So you're just going to give pass the torch on to, for the, that was your characters on to someone else, so they can do with as you please, because you're pretty much washing your hands of it at that point.
Yeah, like he would, otherwise he would probably stay in California if my main characters left and you'd never hear from him again. This way, it adds depth to the series, right? And she can do whatever she wants with him.
And the event we're talking about here, because you wrote California 1 and 2, and it sounds, are you doing California 3 now?
Yeah, I'm about, like, I think I have 105, 106,000 words done on it.
Yeah. That's a lot. Like, the most I've ever written was 85,000 words, and so it's, oh, man, it's such a struggle for me to, because I my lifestyle has changed so much since I first started writing in 2015. But I'm trying, I am putting out a few words here and there. It's just, I'm trying to make progress, some kind of progress. I'm happy with it, but and I'm happy for you because you're doing successful. You're being successful. And I've recently retired and you're retired and we got a little bit more time to do this kind of stuff now. But I know you're still,
did you say time?
No,
I don't know how I ever had enough time to have a full-time job.
I say that, but really I get what you're saying because now I'm like the stay home dad, right? The stay home husband. And so I, there's lots to do on 7.8 acres of land where I live. And I'm trying to homestead this place. I got some woods to clear and I got wood to chop. I cut and I got all this. I'm wildly busy. But it's just work. I traded one kind of work for another work. And I was only retired for like a month and a half. And I'm like, I felt miserable watching my wife get up and go to work. And I'm like staying behind. I just don't feel right to me. And so I did put in some applications. I turned down 4 jobs. I recently got hired back on with a local police department. I haven't had a chance to tell you that yet. So my local police department has hired me back on. I had to be re-fingerprinted again. For what reason, I don't know. They said that I think they lost my prints. I don't know how you lose fingerprints, but I'm waiting to hear back from the Bureau of Police Training to find out, you know, what's, I'm expecting a phone call. Should be any day now. But I'm kind of excited about that. I'm excited about you, my friend. You got a book ready to come out. Why don't you take the next couple minutes and tell us where can we find you? Tell us about your Amazon page, your Facebook page, if you're on Instagram, anything, any projects you got coming up, anything you're working on you would like to share.
If you go to ricktippins.com, RickTippins.com, you can kind of launch from there and go to anything that I have, like whether it's Instagram that you're into, which is, I still question why I'm on Instagram, but because it's not really a book platform, but I am. Amazon, I have a YouTube channel, Facebook, like I said, Instagram, and then you know you can launch, if you want to buy the books, you can get to Amazon from my my webpage, or you can go on to Raventhorne, the publisher has a webpage as well, and they're constantly adding to it. And in fact, we have a meeting here coming up where I think we're trying to put something together that, like, every once a month or once every, I don't know what the time frame is going to be, but like give the fans an opportunity to interact with one or two of the authors, ask questions, you know, and just have some sort of reader interaction. But you can get all the books off of the Raventhorne website if you go there. But if you're looking for specifically mine, you can go to my webpage and you'll find everything there.
Okay, I see you got a YouTube channel as well.
Yeah, it's not got a whole lot of stuff on it yet, but I'm starting to add, like, you know, but we're talking about time, right? We all have, you know, family obligations, you know, writing obligations. So it's hard to, content takes time to create. So what I'm trying to do is do a lot of these backpacking things and talk about gear, because a lot of what I write about in the Jared series, the A World Slowed or the Jared Chronicles, is very gear specific, but it's also written in 2016. So a lot of that stuff's dated now. So I've done a few videos recently walking people through what I'm taking on backpacking trips. And then when I get back, I'm like, okay, I'm not taking that ever again. Or I took this instead of this because it's too big and this is lighter and more efficient, or, you know, not huge gear reviews, but just talking about equipment.
All right, my man. Sounds good. I love hiking. I'm glad to see that you're out there. I'm a fellow hiker also. Something else we got in common. I love hiking. But you hang on tight, all right? I'm gonna do this outro, and I'm going to come back and shoot the breeze with you for a couple more minutes, and I'll talk to you then. Hold on a second.
All right.
All right, I want to thank everybody for joining the Rising Republic. Hey, just retouch on everything we talked about here. Rick Tippins can be reached at ricktippins.com. If you don't fancy going to websites, you can hit him up at rick.tippins on Facebook, and go to his Amazon page. Just click in, type in Rick Tippins, and you'll see Rick Tippins pop up. But hey, I just want to say, everybody, thank you for joining the Rising Republic. Again, I am L. Douglas Hogan, your host. Thank you for coming and stopping by.